I'm delighted now to welcome Avery Anderson Sponholz. She's executive director of the Kivira Coalition, and Courtney White, who is founder and creative director of the Kivira Coalition. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks for having us back.
So we've had you on recently, Courtney. We've talked about your book. We've talked about the Kivira Coalition Conference. I went a couple of weeks ago now to the Kivira Coalition Conference, which is held every year in Albuquerque, and recorded a whole bunch of people who were talking about the work that they are doing, and we're going to hear them later today and over the next 3 weeks. So it's a four-part series covering some of the kind of work that Kivira is doing. And let's just talk a little bit about how this work has evolved since you started, Courtney. What kind of work were you doing, 20 years ago? And how has that shifted to what we're seeing today?
Well, some of it has evolved and changed a lot. Some of it is still largely the same, and I can kind of talk about both parts. So about 1997, when we got started, the world was a pretty different place. We were mostly concerned about finding common ground between ranchers and conservationists, you know, kind of the grazing wars that were going on in the mid-90s, trying to find some peace, some quiet places, which actually led to the annual conference. In 2002, we decided to create kind of a neutral forum for ranchers and conservationists, public lands managers, scientists, everybody who was interested in what we were calling and still calling the Radical Center to come and meet and talk. And it's gone so well over the years that we've continued it, and it's grown to what you saw a couple weeks ago. So that need is still there, the Radical Center idea. In fact, in many ways, it's probably more necessary today than even in the mid-90s, given the kind of the political climate in our country, trying to get conservatives and liberals and ranchers and, you know, farmers and everybody else to, on the same page talking about stuff. And that's a big part of the conference, a big part of what Kivira does. What's changed is that the grazing wars themselves have largely faded away. We've got other issues. I went on a kind of a long journey to figure out how New Mexico land looks. It's largely degraded. I didn't realize that when I got started, meaning that its historical use has been pretty hard. So we've been involved in creek restoration, grazing as an ecological tool, eventually food, where our food comes from, now into climate issues. So the background concerns have expanded and diversified. The conference reflects that, and who comes to speak and who comes to listen. And so it's kind of far away from. So in fact, in my slideshow, I show this little circle of four people out in the middle of a large field, just looking at grasses, and that was kind of Kivira, just a little group looking at the ground. And then today, we made a map for our 2010 conference called our Carbon Ranch, looked at the whole landscape and all the different regenerative and sustainable and resilient activities. And it's a big map now, so we've grown from just a little group looking at grass to a group that's got much wider concerns.
The conference this year was called Back to the Future. What does that refer to? What's that about?
Yeah, so in this year's conference, we were excited. Two parts to that answer. So the first was looking at regenerative agricultural practices that were, in some cases, old practices that needed to have a new twist in order to be brought into sort of the next wave of conservation context.
What's an example of that?
So we had a phenomenal presentation by a series of speakers, but one of whom was Greg Simons, who talked about an entirely revolutionary way using satellite imagery to look at land practices going back to the 1970s. So we've had this sort of methodology where we could go on the ground and we could look at the state of land health today using a variety of sort of on-the-ground surveying methodology. And what Greg Simons is doing is looking at taking Landsat images, satellite images, and being able to go back decades in time to look at the way that land management practices have affected that ground through time. The second half of the conference, or sort of the sub-theme of the conference, was celebrating the International Year of Family Farming and Ranching. 2014 was designated the International Year of Family Farming and Ranching by the United Nations. And so the second part of what we were doing is looking at practices that have evolved since the very beginning of time within a family farming and ranching context. This is the group of people that have been feeding our civilizations for the last 10,000 years. And so celebrating that historical and in some cases prehistoric context that this kind of agriculture the ways that it's profoundly changed the planet.
Some of those ways are good and some are not so good, as we will hear during our series. But what is the state of family farming in the United States? It seems like so many family farms fell to the practice of agribusiness and these vast monocropping farms.
So in the United States, the percentage of the population involved in agriculture generally is just 2%. In fact, I think it's less than 2%. So all our food in America is produced by 2% of the population. Most of that's industrial food production. So the number of per family farmers, sustainable, resilient, organic, whatever you want to call it, is actually, you know, a fraction of that 2%. So we're talking about small numbers. What's interesting, though, is that globally, family farmers are a much bigger part of the agricultural pie. I mean, there's, especially in Africa, Asia, where most of the food is produced at local and family scales. And that's something that we kind of forget about, how the rest of the world does this. In fact, the United Nations is very keen on helping those family farmers stay in business, survive, grow, because they feed so many people. And so we have a lot to learn from the rest of the world in that respect. So the organic movement is growing, so the number of farms may be small, the number of farmers may be small, but it's, you know, there's an upward trend here, which is just good, and we're trying to help that trend ourselves through various activities, the conference being one, but also Kavir runs an apprenticeship program that puts young people on progressive farms.
And we see just enormous potential in this because 40% of the land base here in the United States is in production agriculture. So sort of our opportunities to affect landscape scale soil carbon, that in comparison with only 5% of our national land base in wilderness, the agricultural lands are really that's where we have an opportunity to make a tremendous impact. And so highlighting stories of family farms that are doing a remarkable job and helping to facilitate conversations that on a national basis moves us from that sort of big agribusiness that's stripped the soil of everything that's good and useful that Christine Jones talked about during her presentation, and putting it under the stewardship of people who are knowledgeable about how to create regenerative systems is something that we want to highlight those stories and celebrate them, and then hopefully create an opportunity for more.
We're talking to Courtney White and Avery Anderson Sponholz from the Kivira Coalition. One of the things that I got out of this whole set of conversations that happened at the conference and that we'll be talking about over the next several weeks is this crazy, amazing, I'm calling it a win-win-win-win-win situation, where when you do, for example, agricultural practices that don't involve tilling the soil, but rather injecting the seeds into the soil, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past with you, Courtney, but it's this whole practice called no-till agriculture, and when you do that, you put vast amounts of carbon back into the soil, takes carbon dioxide out of the air, makes for this rich, dark, healthy, nutrient-full, biotic topsoil. It's less work for the farmer. The farmer gets more money per acre from the crops, and sometimes vastly more, like an order of magnitude more money per acre. They don't have to spend money on chemicals. You've got a carbon sink. I mean, there's so many advantages to it and so few, if any, disadvantages to it, except for just learning how to do it.
That's correct. In fact, I can tell you from my own experience, when I started looking to farming issues as opposed to ranching issues, you know, I hadn't really thought a lot about the plow, right? And the plow, you know, there's a plow hieroglyph on the wall of an Egyptian temple 5,000 years ago. We've been plowing for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, as it turns out, there's actually no reason to plow. There's a there's an agronomist in the 40s who wrote a book who said there's no scientific reason to till. And what he means is, why are we tilling? Why are we doing this? We've been doing it for a long time. Doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. So plowing turns the soil over. It exposes the microbes in the soil, which is part of the biology of the soil, which is necessary to organic food production. And it kills them. It exposes them to sunlight and wind and temperature, that sort of stuff. So what's happening here, this is the Back to the Future part, that there's a sort of a movement back to pre-plowing agriculture, keeping the ground covered, having plants grow and put the roots down, all that kind of stuff. And the classic example is kind of what we did to the Great Plains, the prairies. You know, we busted the sod. When the homesteading took place, we turned all that sod over. When that happens, you lose the fertility, you lose the carbon, you lose the life in the soil, and you need to put that fertility back in the with chemical fertilizers. And that's how we got the chemical agriculture that dominates food production today. So it's all about nature. Nature has the best ideas, right? So biology and plants and green things growing and roots going down and carbon being stored. So that's very much a way of kind of going back to nature's model of not just growing plants, but herbivory and the way creeks function and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty exciting.
The potential for, I mean, first of all, the fact that the soil is degraded because it has lost so much carbon, lost so much organic matter over the last decades and centuries, is something that I don't think most people really get how huge a contribution to climate change that is. First of all, and second, the fact that when you, through the process of photosynthesis, take the carbon back out of the air and put it into the soil, the potential for storing carbon there permanently by creating living soils that are very rich and very nutritive for the plants growing in them, that potential is vast. I mean, you know, you Google climate change and you get these weird, kludgy things about a smokestack going into some kind of device that then conducts CO2 into the bottom of a pit somewhere, and it's like, right, you got to be kidding. This is actually doing it through nature.
Yeah, there's two parts, and I want to be clear that folks understand that while we can sequester carbon in soils, as well as trees and green things, and that's a big part of the equation, and you'll be hearing about it, it's also important to remember that we need to stop burning coal and oil and natural gas. So we can't, and it kind of gets lost in the mix here, because people
right.
think, well, we're going to like do this. You know, if we just keep digging up buried carbon, coal, for example, and burning it and putting it in the atmosphere, it just makes the job harder for everybody. That said, what's neat about the mitigation side of this, which is how you deal with too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is in excess, is you know, trees are well known as a carbon sink. Soils are less well known, and that's what's going on right now. Folks have begun to understand, scientists as well as farmers and ranchers and people who live in cities, that you can build rich soil that's carbon mostly through, you know, gardening, through plant photosynthesis, through ranching and farming, and then if you do it right and the roots go deep and the carbon goes out into the soil, it can be stored for long periods of time if you don't disturb it with a plow, for
right.
example. So it all fits together that way. Actually, they've done the math that you can actually potentially pull down large amounts of carbon dioxide and store it in the soils. I mean, there's lots of complicating parts to that. How do you do it? How does it stay? How do you get best management practices out there? But what's neat about this is nothing needs to be invented.
Right.
We don't have to go invent something like carbon capture and storage, which you're talking about, which is a high-tech process of injecting carbon into caves or mines
right.
or something. They haven't figured that out yet.
And it costs billions of dollars.
And someone's going to control that and make money from it, which, you know, money is okay. We like the kind of money that farmers and ranchers make instead by producing food.
This is free because the plants are doing it for you.
It's not only free. Photosynthesis has been around for an awfully long time. And, again, nature has the best ideas. Nature's been processing carbon dioxide since, I don't know, at least a billion years. I mean, so we come along, and, you know, kind of the background issue is humans just keep thinking we know best, and we keep kind of toying with stuff, messing things up, when nature had already figured this stuff out for us. So that's where the Back to the Future element comes in.
I think the other thing is when people talk about carbon sequestration, you think about somebody in a jail cell or whatever. You think about carbon storage, or the storage evokes barrels or closed closets full of things. What we're talking about when we talk about storage here is creating living, breathing, rich, good soils that are doing things like absorbing water instead of letting it run off the land and things like that. So storage is a almost misleading word, although we have to use it.
And then you have the, I mean, for the consumer of food, which we all fall squarely into that camp, there's a ramification, as we heard from the person that opened up on Thursday morning, Joe Robinson. The ramifications for healthy soils, the nutritional ramifications for our food are also tremendous. So this is, you know, for the person that maybe hasn't had the opportunity to travel in the way that Courtney has and interface with all of these farmers and ranchers who are thinking about landscape sale carbon sequestration, anybody who's picked up an apple and sort of thought about that apple as they paid for it in the grocery store as an opportunity to make their family, bring nutrients into their family system, should be concerned about this as well, because we are the sort of the desiccation of our soil is also the desiccation of our own human health as it plays out through sort of our food system.
One of the things, I think it was in her book, is the soils are so depleted that some oranges have no vitamin C, some apples have almost no nutrients, and the difference between one apple and the next, although they may taste similar or the same, can be really vast, and it has so much to do with soil.
And that's happened in a generation. The apples that my father was eating when he was a boy are some shocking percentage, like 40% less nutritious than the apple that he fed me as a kid. And that's that has a human health and sort of human well-being ramification that links. You know, Kivera is an organization that spends a lot of time thinking about land health and about watershed health and about the health of agricultural systems. But this has a profound impact for all of us here in cities as well, or anybody who considers themselves a part of our eating system.
So we're talking about the Kivera Coalition, and as you said a moment ago, one of the things that Kivera is doing is giving opportunities to young farmers. There seems to be a trend, and I don't know how much of a trend it really is, maybe you can tell us, of young people who didn't necessarily grow up on farms going into agriculture as a career. What does that look like? What's going on? I mean, one of the things about it is these young people are bringing a lot of creativity and let's do it in new ways kind of attitude toward these practices.
Yeah, and we heard from Doran Cox at the conference as well as Donaga Markegaard. So two people who had maybe not an enormous amount of exposure to agriculture in their youth, but found as they sought meaningful work in becoming adults that the process of linking that human well-being and land health together were the most meaningful kind of work that they could contribute to. When I first came to Kivera, got started a program that we called the New Agrarian Program, and it's now under the sound leadership of my colleague Virginie Planto. But what we've done in that program, starting at a very small scale, is create opportunities for exactly the kind of person that you've just described. Didn't necessarily grow up in agriculture, but finding, increasingly we're finding that more and more young people are looking for meaningful work, not wanting to go into sort of the broken economic systems or political systems that previously were the way the majority of my generation turned, and instead looking for ways to return to a landscape that provided meaningful work. And so Kivera's own program provides apprenticeships for a handful of young people, and then we are collaborating with lots of other organizations like the National Young Farmers Coalition, which has a chapter here in the Rio Grande Valley, and Agrarian Trust and the Greenhorns, which are headed up by Severin von Charner Fleming. And so these are the kind of organizations that we're now seeing a kind of service provider organization that's making possible for young people to find opportunities and partnerships and meaningful business opportunities within agriculture as a professional field.
And they're bringing lots of things to that, and we'll hear from Dorn Cox during this series that we're airing for the next several Mondays. But they're bringing all kinds of stuff to it, like smartphones and, you know, high-tech attitudes and networking and a kind of, I mean, it seems like a different kind of communalism, but still a kind of communal attitude that maybe their parents who went back to the land in the 70s had at one time.
We're seeing, yeah, the interjection of technology into this movement. We're also seeing there is a deep appreciation for what Dorn is accomplishing is happening on the shoulders of all of the people that went before him in agriculture. And so it's not sort of solely an entirely new thing that's come from nothing. It's come from, you know, the constituency that's been attending the Kivera conference for the last more than a decade now, that we have a lot of really good practices that have been pioneered by a mentor generation. And I am particularly excited about the way in which the sort of the Dorn Coxes of the world, as they invent FarmHack, they're learning from they're taking the knowledge of their mentors and sort of valuing their mentors in that process, and sort of moving forward as an entirely a new agrarian community that involves young people and involves, you know, Speaker Fred Kirschman. I loved in his talk when he said, "We need more new agrarians like me." And he's he's probably in his 70s and is, you know, he's the epitome of the new agrarian movement. And he needs to be right there alongside Dorn in pioneering all of these methodologies.
So you really have a kind of multi-generational coalition of people who are working with each other.
Indeed, yeah.
So it's just about time to go because we want to leave room for Gabe and Paul Brown, who are going to come to us after the break. I want to thank you both for being with us on the Radio Cafe, Avery Anderson Sponholt, who is Executive Director of the Kivera Coalition, and Courtney White, who is the founder and now Creative Director. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you again for having us on your show.
Thank you.